Good afternoon. It's a privilege as well as a pleasure to introduce Frederick Schauer, David and Mary Harrison, Distinguished Professor of Law. Fred is new to the permanent faculty, but not new to the law school. He was here as the Ewald Distinguished Visiting Professor in 1996, and well before that enjoyed the friendship and admiration of many of our professors. It was a tremendous source of satisfaction for us when Fred agreed last year to join the Virginia faculty. One of David Harrison's principal objectives in making the largest gift that the law school has ever received, the gift that made the David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professorships possible, was to attract to Virginia scholars of the first rank. Were David alive today, I have no doubt that he would be absolutely delighted to see how brilliantly that objective has been realized in Fred's appointment to the Harrison Chair. Fred is a graduate of Dartmouth College, Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business, and Harvard Law School. He began his teaching career at William & Mary and moved to Michigan and Harvard before coming to Virginia. In addition to his Ewald visit here, he has been a visitor at Dartmouth, the University of Chicago, New York University, the University of Toronto, and Oxford University. His invited lectures are too numerous to list. He has been a Guggenheim Fellow and is a Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. These are tangible signals of a more basic fact. Fred is one of the most prominent and influential legal scholars in the world. He has grappled with issues of first importance to the design of the legal system. Fred made his name as a scholar of the First Amendment and of jurisprudence, focusing on the nature and function of legal rules. Interestingly, those two strands of Fred's output were closely connected from the start. An excellent example of that connection is Fred's 1981 article, Categories and the First Amendment, A Play in Three Acts. In it, Fred provides not a theory of the First Amendment, but rather a demonstration of how thinking carefully about the nature and methodology of legal rulemaking can illuminate strands of First Amendment doctrine that seem otherwise confused or arbitrary. In particular, he provides a coherent and perceptive understanding of the commercial speech case Virginia State Board of Pharmacy versus Virginia Citizens Consumer Council. As the article points out, we can make much more sense of the case if we focus not on the question, why did the court decide the way it did, but rather on the question, why did the court frame the issue the way it did? Logically, in deciding whether a particular item fits into a particular category, such as whether commercial speech falls within the category protected under the First Amendment, one can either start with a narrow core of things that are clearly covered and decide whether we should expand, or start by assuming that the entire population is encompassed within the category and ask whether we should exclude. Fred shows that the court chose to do the latter, and it is this, rather than the particular answer to the question, that deserves analysis and explanation. Vince Blasi has noted that Fred's general approach to the First Amendment is free of the usual vague references to the marketplace of ideas or the importance of expression to self-actualization. Rather, it is rooted in a skepticism about the government's ability to make fine distinctions accurately and disinterestedly through ad hoc decision-making. In short, the First Amendment exists for all of the reasons rules exist. As Fred consistently notes, policymakers face not merely the choice between Rule A and Rule B, but also the more fundamental choice between having a rule that constrains the decision-maker or simply giving the decision-maker plenary discretion within some domain. In looking over Fred's publications, two things stand out. First, of course, is that the list goes on for pages and pages. The most recent entry dates from today. Fred's new book, Thinking Like a Lawyer, is hot off the press, and although I haven't made my way all the way through it since he handed it to me at the door, I recommend it highly. Fred is truly one of the most prolific scholars in legal academia. The second thing that strikes me is how many of the titles of his articles are one or two words long. That strikes me as a very simple way of assessing how fundamental are the problems with which Fred grapples in his scholarship. The third point of interest is that most of the articles are a good deal shorter than the norm in law reviews. Fred is a master of biting off a manageable problem and analyzing it with characteristic care and elegance. Please welcome our newest David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professor, Fred Schauer.
Thank you, Paul, for that extraordinarily, not only extraordinarily generous, but extraordinarily informed, whether well-informed or ill-informed, I'm not sure, introduction. You clearly did your homework, and I'm very grateful. So let me say two things at the outset. First, that being at this school with a distinguished and engaged faculty, smart and diligent students, some of whom are here demonstrating remarkable tolerance for listening to me talk just in one afternoon, wonderful facilities and an amazingly helpful staff and administration, is quite simply a great privilege. Second, I consider being awarded the Harrison Chair an enormous and arguably undeserved honor. And so I'm looking forward to spending many years trying to deserve the privilege and live up to the honor. There's no better way to commence that task, I think, than to devote this lecture not to talking about myself, but instead to talking about ideas. And the idea, or at least the question, I want to talk about is the question of how the legal system should receive the possibility that modern advances in the brain sciences may allow more accurate determinations of veracity, lie detecting, than the ones that currently dominate the litigation process. More specifically, I want to challenge the view widespread among the scientists most familiar with these advances that the neuroscience of lie detecting is not yet nearly good enough to be used in civil and criminal litigation. But I do not want to make claims for the science of lie detecting that go beyond the existing knowledge, or, more importantly, that go beyond my own ability to speak about science, which on my good days is very limited and on the other days is an embarrassing exercise in ignorance. Rather, I want to argue that the enterprise of law has different goals than the enterprise of science, different norms than the enterprise of science, and accordingly that there is no more reason to impose the standards of science on law than there is to impose the standards of law on science. Law must and should use science and should always prefer good science to bad science. But sometimes good science may still not be good enough for law, and sometimes, and hence the title of this lecture, bad science, by the standards of scientists, may still have valuable legal uses. So let me back up a little bit and describe the current controversy about lie detection. It is a controversy that in some respects should come as no surprise. The common law litigation process places huge reliance on the sworn testimony of witnesses, a fact that is itself worthy of note. Many other methods of factual investigation, after all, employ dramatically different approaches. The scientist who seeks to determine whether drinking red wine reduces the likelihood of heart disease does not summon representatives of the wine industry and the Temperance League to each make their cases, following which she decides which of the two is more believable. Rather, she goes out and engages in the kind of primary research that we call experimentation. So too with historians when they do original archival research, psychologists when they conduct experiments on subjects, empirical economists when they perform multiple regressions of large data sets, oceanographers when they explore the sea, or researchers for policymakers when they combine all these techniques and others to determine the factual terrain on which they will make policy. Once we understand the array of other techniques for determining facts, for figuring out simply what is or was the case, we can understand as well that the legal system is highly unusual in relying so heavily on a method in which the party-generated witnesses purport to provide information as to which they, but not the trier of fact, have firsthand knowledge, and in which the trier of fact is typically precluded from obtaining the firsthand knowledge that in other domains is the gold standard for empirical inquiry. Still, the legal system we have, warts and all, unusual as it is within the realm of empirical inquiry, is one in which it is very important, quite often, to determine which of two opposing witnesses is telling the truth. Not all of the litigation process involves a conflict between a truth teller and a liar. Honest misperceptions and more or less honest omissions, exaggerations, shadings, fudgings, slantings, bendings, and hedgings are an omnipresent feature of modern litigation. But so too is flat-out lying. And it should come as no surprise that trying to determine whether which witness is lying has been an important part of many trials. Traditionally, of course, this task has been given to the trier of fact, most visibly, even if not most frequently, the jury, which is charged with assessing the demeanor of a witness, his past record of truth-telling, or not, the internal coherence of the story, and the external coherence of the story with the stories of others, among other things, in order to find out who is telling the truth and who is not, what is the case and what is not. Enter science. Because the traditional ways of evaluating the veracity of a witness have been notoriously unreliable, the quest for a scientific way of distinguishing the truth teller from the liar has been with us for generations. Indeed, what for many years was the standard test for determining the admissibility of scientific evidence, the Fry test, arose in the District of Columbia Circuit in 1923 in the context of the attempted but ultimately unsuccessful admission into evidence of a rudimentary lie detection machine invented by William Moulton Marston, a man possibly better known to some of you as the creator of the comic book character Wonder Woman, among whose attributes was the possession of a magic lasso forged from the magic girdle of Aphrodite, which would make anyone it encircled tell the truth without fail. The device at issue in Fry was a polygraph and not a magic lasso. But not only did Fry set the standard for the admission of scientific evidence for more than half a century, its exclusion of lie detection technology paved the way for the continuing exclusion, with few exceptions, of lie detection evidence in American courts. The science of lie detection has improved considerably since 1923, but not by so much as to lead to a change in judicial attitudes. Indeed, with the replacement in the federal courts of Fry in 1993 by Daubert versus Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals, with the latter's insistence on various indicia of scientific reliability as a precondition for admissibility, the situation has remained much the same. What makes the foregoing of some interest is the rapidly changing state of cognitive neuroscience, the study of human thinking using various methods of examining actual brain activity, as opposed simply to the behaviors that such brain activity generates. The methods of modern neuroscience are numerous, but the most prominent of them is fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging technology, commonly called brain scanning. An fMRI test is able, at its best, to determine just which parts of the brain are being used for which cognitive tasks. Although novices seeing an fMRI are prone to believe that certain parts of the brain light up when engaged in certain tasks, what actually happens is that the portion of the brain being used recruits more oxygenated blood cells to help it in its task. And thus what looks like a lit up part of the brain is actually a part of the brain that has more oxygenated hemoglobin in it than it had when it was less or differently cognitively engaged. As might perhaps now be apparent, the development of fMRI technology has led some researchers to believe that the technology can be effective in distinguishing liars from truth tellers. If, and it is a huge if, different parts of the brain are used for lying than for truth telling, then the possibility exists of using a brain scan to determine whether the person whose brain is being scanned is lying or telling the truth. Or so it is claimed. And so especially is it claimed by those who see the commercial potential for just this technology. Companies such as, I am not making this up, No Lie MRI, and CEPHOS, C-E-P-H-O-S, have already begun marketing their lie-detecting services, and they have been at the forefront of those touting the courtroom potential of the new technology. Neuroscience-based lie detection follows a long history of lie detection technology. The earliest polygraphs were based on blood pressure, and more modern techniques include electroencephalography, which measures electric current generated by the brain, the analysis of facial microexpressions of the kind developed by the psychologist Paul Ekman and now at the center of a new television series, preorbital thermography, which measures the temperature around the eyes, and near-infrared spectroscopy, which uses infrared light to measure changes in blood flow and is thus the precursor of the even newer fMRI technology. Among all of these techniques, I focus on fMRI not only because there are limits to the number of times I am willing to try to pronounce electroencephalography in public, but also because it is, by all accounts, the most reliable of all of these techniques, although plainly not reliable enough to be promoted for use in court, even by many of those most familiar with the technology. Indeed, in legal and policy debates, almost as much as in physics, every action appears to produce an equal and opposite reaction. And so it has been with the reaction of mainstream academic neuroscientists to the claims about the lie detection potential of fMRI scans. A prominent article by a Stanford law professor and Stanford neuroscientist surveyed all of the existing studies of neuroscience-based lie detection and concluded that all of the results fell far short of existing scientific standards of proof. Accordingly, they urged a legally imposed moratorium, a total ban, on the use of the technology until its reliability according to scientific standards could be established to the satisfaction of a federal regulatory agency. Similarly, one leading neuroscientist has insisted that there is no compelling evidence that fMRIs will work for lie detection in the real world. Note the word compelling, to which I shall return presently. And thus, for her, should not be admissible in court. And still another has said that she wants to drive a stake through the heart of the emerging movement to use neuroscience to assist or even replace the trier of fact as the ultimate determiner of truth and falsity in courts of law. At the core of the neuroscientist's claim is the claim that the existing state of the research is bad science. The tests that have been done, they say, are different in major ways from real-world lying and truth-telling, and thus it is a mistake to draw an inference from the accuracy of neural lie detecting in experimental settings to the potential accuracy in detecting real-world liars. Moreover, many of the results have not been published in peer-reviewed journals, and many of the experiments have been performed by those with a commercial interest in the outcome. And further, the alleged degree of accuracy, 90% according to some claims of neural lie detecting, is, say most of the experts, considerably higher than what the experimental data actually show. To the extent that the proponents of neural lie detecting are maintaining that their claims about the reliability and accuracy of these methods are scientifically sound, they have been properly exposed as relying on bad science. Without better evidence of external validity, without more rigorous scrutiny of the existing claims of reliability, and without higher rates of accuracy, the claimed ability to use fMRI testing to identify liars is just that, a claim, and far from what good scientists should and do take as a sound scientific conclusion. But that is far from the end of the story, the arguments of the skeptics notwithstanding. And thus there may be good reasons to doubt that the admitted scientific failings of fMRI-based lie detection are or should be dispositive for law. First, law is about far more than putting criminals in jail, although that is the fear that motivates so much of the criticism. One of the scientists just noted said that the results would be especially unreliable if the subject believed that the results could send him to prison. And another has worried about a future in which the police may request a warrant to search your brain. These are legitimate worries, but the seriousness of the worry depends largely on a view of the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination that would characterize an involuntary lie detection test of whatever kind as non-testimonial, and that seems to me highly unlikely, albeit not impossible, under current law. Given that law enforcement authorities may typically not require a suspect to talk at all, it is hard to imagine a legal state of affairs in which a defendant's statement is subject to an involuntary neuroscientific evaluation of its validity. But even if a future that included brain scan warrants is a legitimate worry, it takes a rather large leap to transpose that worry to numerous other potential courtroom uses of lie detection technology. Most importantly, the question of what the prosecution or the police can use against a defendant or a suspect is very different from the question of what a defendant can use to attempt to establish his innocence according to legal standards. Let us suppose, to put some very conservative numbers on the existing research, that an fMRI evaluation of a defendant's claim of innocence, "I was somewhere else," or "he started the fight," for example, has an accuracy rate of 60%. It is of course clear that we would not want to imprison people based on a 60% probability of their guilt, but that is not the question. Rather, if there is a 60% chance that a defendant's claim of innocence is accurate, would we want to say that his guilt has been proved beyond a reasonable doubt? Indeed, this was exactly the issue in the 1998 Supreme Court case of United States versus Sheffer, involving a defendant in a military court-martial who sought to introduce a polygraph test in his own defense. But the Supreme Court, over Justice Stevens's dissent and a concern expressed by four justices who concurred only in the judgment, held that there was no federal constitutional right for a defendant to offer polygraphic exculpatory evidence. But that there may not be such a constitutional right, however, does not answer the policy question whether the majority's simple distinction between reliable and unreliable masks the important distinction between how reliable evidence must be in order to allow its use to a defendant who wishes to raise the possibility of a reasonable doubt as to his guilt. Thus, any scientific test has a level of reliability, but whether that level of reliability is high enough depends on why we are using it. If we are using it as the sole evidence of whether a defendant should go to prison, we would want very, 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 very high standards of reliability. If we are using it as part of a larger story about whether a defendant should go to prison, then perhaps the level of reliability can be a bit lower. A brick is not a wall, as the famous adage in the law of evidence goes. And if we are using it to show why a defendant should not go to prison, then the level of reliability can be lower still, arguably much lower. After all, we do not and should not have a system in which a defendant goes to prison unless he can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he is not guilty. All of this applies as well to civil cases. We apply the standard of proof by a preponderance of the evidence in almost all civil cases, because the system is committed to the view that failure to award damages, say, to an injured or otherwise wronged plaintiff is every bit as serious an error as is wrongly requiring a non-culpable defendant to pay damages. And once again, therefore, it is hardly clear that a party in a civil lawsuit seeking to bolster his assertions about facts should be precluded from doing so by use of a method whose reliability is nowhere near sufficient to send someone to prison. Awarding damages is less serious than sending someone to prison, or so our legal system believes, and as long as that is so, then it is a mistake to assume that a uniform standard of reliability should govern all legal uses of a particular type of evidence. One prominent argument against the foregoing is that juries are not very good at distinguishing one piece of evidence from another, and that as a result, superficially persuasive pseudo-scientific evidence will have more of an effect on jury deliberations than it should have, and that one such brick will in fact constitute the entire wall for many jurors. Yet even apart from the fact that jury trials are a small and diminishing proportion of all trials, the existing state of the empirical evidence on jury overvaluation is decidedly mixed. And if we subject the claims of jury overvaluation to the same scrutiny that we subject scientific evidence itself, we may find that the scientific basis for excluding bad scientific evidence is itself an example of less than ideal science. So at least there is the possibility that jurors may understand more than we think they do, and the more important possibility that the use of some types of evidence, like the actual practice with respect to hearsay and many other exclusions, may vary with whether it is a judge or a jury who is the trier of fact. Still, another widespread argument against the view that standards of reliability should vary with their legal uses maintains that there is too much contamination across uses to be comfortable with legal compartmentalization of standards of reliability. That is, there is a worry that allowing fMRI lie detection by a defendant as a way of supporting his claim of innocence will lead to allowance of the same technique by the prosecution as a way of sending a defendant to jail, or by a plaintiff as a way of obtaining damages against a non-culpable defendant in a civil case. It would be wrong to deny that possibility. But again, it is a bit ironic that those who are most insistent about finding a sound scientific and empirical basis for various forms of evidence are often comfortable abandoning the science in favor of their own hunches when the question is about the potential downstream dangers of allowing certain forms of evidence to be used for a particular purpose. Those dangers may exist, but as of yet, there is no compelling scientific evidence to support such a view. It may be true, but at the moment, the empirical support for the view that allowing fMRI lie detection by a defendant in a criminal case will lead to allowing fMRI lie detection by the prosecution against an unwilling defendant is far weaker than the admittedly weak empirical support for the view that fMRI lie detection can actually distinguish liars from truth tellers. Thus, in law as well as in science, one of the most important questions is compared to what? And it is a question usefully applied to the determination of witness veracity in courts of law. Traditionally, that determination has been left to the scientifically unaided determination of the trier of fact, often the jury, but just what are the mechanisms that the trier of fact uses to make these determinations? We know that jurors often use characteristics other than the content of what a witness says to evaluate the truth of a witness's claim. We know that these non-content characteristics include things such as whether a witness looks up or down, whether a witness fidgets, a characteristic of particular interest to me, whether a witness speaks slowly or quickly, and many other things. And we know from serious research that these alleged indicators of veracity are at best highly unreliable and at worst systematically misleading. And this is why numerous studies of the ability of untrained people to determine truth-telling in others rarely show reliability levels above 60%, where 50% would be random. Moreover, the problem is exacerbated by the rules of evidence themselves, which presume on the basis of venerable superstition and not much more than that, that those who have been convicted of crimes are more likely to lie than those who have not, which allow witnesses to offer testimony about whether other witnesses have a reputation in the community for lying or truth-telling, and which allow witnesses to offer their personal opinions about the general credibility of other witnesses. We are thus in a position to reframe the question. The question is not, or at least not only, the question of whether fMRI-based lie detection is reliable enough in the abstract to be used in court. Rather, the question is whether there are good reasons to prohibit the use of evidence of veracity that is probably better than the evidence of veracity that now dominates the litigation process, and is at the very least no worse. The choice is not between very good evidence of veracity and less good, bad, if you will, fMRI evidence. Rather, it is between bad fMRI evidence and the even worse evidence that is not only permitted, but forms the core of the common law trial process. The tone of the foregoing notwithstanding, it is not my purpose here to argue for the admissibility of fMRI-based lie detection evidence. Rather, it is to suggest that the reliability standards for scientific evidence that the courts should use must be standards that come from the legal goals of the legal system and not from the scientific goals of the scientific system. Science can tell us that a certain scientific process has, for example, a 12% error rate or a certain rate of false positives and a certain rate of false negatives. And scientists can and should, for scientific purposes, decide whether such a rate is sufficient for a scientist to assert that something is the case, or sufficient for publication, or sufficient for some other internal scientific purpose. But whether that error rate is sufficient for a trier of fact to hear it, or sufficient to put someone in jail, or sufficient to keep someone out of jail, or support an injunction or an award of damages, is not itself a scientific question. Much the same applies to the methods of inquiry. Science properly relies on peer review and on numerous other indicia of sound methodology. But whether those indicia are the right ones for purposes of non-scientific action, including but not limited to courtroom verdicts, is not itself a scientific question, and to think otherwise is often, albeit not necessarily, to believe erroneously that one can derive a legal or policy ought from a scientific is. Evidence cognoscenti may detect in much of this a challenge to Daubert itself, and that may be so. Daubert and its successors, General Electric versus Joyner and Cummo Tire versus Carmichael, were directed to the problem of products liability and mass tort verdicts that were based on persuasive junk science. And no one who reads the description of the tire failure expert in Cummo Tire can fail to recognize that the junk science problem is a real one. And we certainly want to guard against the world in which experts in astrology, phrenology, and countless other bogus ologies have a place in the courtroom. Moreover, and as an important and very recent, just last month, National Academy of Sciences study has documented in great detail a significant amount of traditionally used forensic identification evidence. Bite marks, shoe prints, handwriting analysis, and even fingerprints may have less scientific support than their proponents claim. But once again, the compared to what question looms. Bad science is worse than good science, but is it worse than the non-science that lurks in the minds of judges and jurors? Is it worse than the superstitions and urban legends that influence so much of public policymaking and legal decision-making? Daubert is based on the very good idea that manufacturers of products should not be held liable for damages unless there is a sound scientific basis for believing that some negligent act of a manufacturer actually caused some injury to the user of the product. But we do not have a civil litigation system in which we prohibit those who are injured in automobile accidents from recovering unless they can show with scientific reliability that the defendant was driving negligently, nor do we have a criminal litigation system in which we prohibit defendants from offering a wide range of non-scientific evidence to keep them out of prison. Requiring that all legal determinations of guilt or innocence, liability or non-liability, be guided by science seems utopian in both the best and worst senses of the word. Best in the sense that such a system might in fact be much more just than the one that we in fact have. Worst in the sense that it would require such a dismantling of the entire edifice of common law adjudication that it is not only fanciful to think that it might ever happen, but also that attempting to make the existing system more scientific by keeping out bad science while not doing anything about the non-science with which the entire system is infused may produce a system that is in fact less scientific just because it keeps out somewhat poor science in favor of keeping in the really poor science that sneaks in by not billing itself as science at all. At the heart of the controversy may be the justified concern of scientists to keep their scientific enterprise as free as possible from non-scientific taint. When science that is not yet ready for prime scientific time is commandeered for commercial gain, the enterprise of science suffers. And that is exactly what has happened with the commercialization of fMRI-based lie detection. To encourage the use of shoddy science for legal or policy purposes is worse for science and, in the long run, may, and this too is an empirical question, hurt us all by making science worse. But the tension between the valuable goals of long-term scientific integrity and short-term uses of scientific output is hardly a new one and hardly unique to lie detection or to the law of evidence. When medical researchers performing placebo-controlled experiments reach a point at which they suspect but do not yet know that a new drug will cure a fatal disease, they face a moral dilemma. A dilemma faced by Dr. Martin Arrowsmith in Sinclair Lewis's great novel, Arrowsmith. A moral dilemma about whether to sacrifice science to immediate suffering or sacrifice people to long-term scientific integrity. The stakes here may be smaller, but the question is the same. If incomplete or shoddy or commercially motivated science is usable in law, science will suffer. But if incomplete or shoddy or commercially motivated science is barred from the law in the name of science, law's own goals may suffer, and the tension and necessary trade-offs between the goals of law and the goals of science can never be completely eliminated. It is the conceit of the academic that there is no problem so large, so important, and so interesting that it cannot be better seen as but an example of an even larger, even more important, and even more interesting problem. And so too with the question of the legal standards to be applied to scientific evidence. That the evaluation of science within the legal system is and should be based on characteristically legal standards and norms is just one more example of the partial distinctiveness of legal thinking, legal analysis, and legal decision-making. This is not a plug for that book, but it could be, if that were the kind of thing that I were comfortable doing, which, of course, I'm not. Judges routinely base their decisions on precedent and stare decisis. But every elementary textbook on informal logic treats an argument from past practice as a fallacy. Lawyers are expected to rely on authority, but thoughtful scientists recognize that reliance on scientific authority is in substantial tension with scientific method. When Blackstone observed that it is better that 10 guilty men go free than that one innocent be punished, he not only drew on ideas now associated with type 1 and type 2 errors and false positives and false negatives, but also made clear that law's own goals required subjugating maximum accuracy to the transcendent value of personal liberty. In all these respects and more, it is a mistake to assume that the job of law is to enforce or replicate the decision-making modes of other disciplines and other domains. And so it is with the standards that the law uses to determine whether evidence, scientific and otherwise, is sufficiently reliable to be usable for this or that purpose. Law should listen to what the neuroscientists say about neuroscience, but it should be attentive to their adjectives and to their adverbs. When neuroscientists say that there is no compelling evidence of fMRI's lie-detecting reliability, when they say that there is very little basis for confidence in the results produced so far, or when they say that claims about fMRIs have been made prematurely, they are imposing an evaluative standard on the experimental results. That is as it should be, for we cannot make sense of these results without having some evaluative standard. But the evaluative standard to be used by the law, even when it is science that is being evaluated, must be based on law's goals, law's purposes, and law's structures. And as is so often the case, what is good outside of law may not be good enough inside it. Less obvious, but often more important, is the corollary, that what is not good enough outside of law may be good enough for parts of law. I look forward to many years of discussion of these and other ideas in such a marvelous environment for intellectual inquiry, scientific and otherwise. Thank you.